Earlier this month, it was the 50th anniversary of Pablo Picasso's death, and the art critic Sebastian Smee wrote, "We're still trying to clean up his mess." One of the messes he left was his treatment of the women in his life. He was an unrepentant misogynist. So what are you supposed to do if you love Picasso's art? Do you give that up because he was a bastard to women? In a new book, the writer Claire Dieterer works through the problem of loving someone who has done a terrible thing. Dieterer says she wants to be a virtuous consumer, but also a citizen of the world of art. So here's the question she asks in her book. How do I maintain myself between these contradictions? Today in Radio West, she'll join us to talk about this fan's dilemma after this.
Being a dependable, trustworthy news source, that's our goal at KUER. In order to meet that goal, we depend on listener contributions. Your support ensures the local and national news heard on KUER remains independent, commercial-free, and accessible for all. If you rely on our programming to stay informed, become our newest sustainer with a gift of just $5 a month. Start your monthly support at KUER.org/donate.
It's not hard to find a list of people who have fallen from grace or been canceled or however you want to describe an artist whose work has come into question because of their life. Here's a few the writer Claire Dieterer includes in her new book: Bill Cosby, Michael Jackson, Miles Davis, Pablo Picasso. In the book, Dieterer wonders, what if there were this online calculator where you plug in the name of the artist and it computes the person's transgression measured against the greatness of the art, and then it spits out a verdict. It's okay or it's not okay to listen to David Bowie or see a Woody Allen movie. Now, of course, such a thing does not exist, but Dieterer says our moral sense does have to be made to come into balance with what she calls our art love. And how do you do it? That's what the book is about. And here's a spoiler. There isn't one universal balance. It's different for everyone. Dieterer started thinking about this in 2014, where she says in the book she found herself locked in a battle with an appalling genius, the film director Roman Polanski.
I thought of him as this kind of straw man or totem figure of the predatory male of the 1970s. Because of his rape of a 13-year-old girl. I was coming to his history with my own experience because I had also been predated, not raped, but this was also my experience. So I was really kind of vulnerable around this topic. And I researched and researched the topic, and I learned a lot of what there was to know. I read the deposition from the girl's point of view. And I came away from all of that still feeling that I wanted to consume the work. The movie I write about in the book is really bringing it home to me, the beauty and the kind of undeniable quality of Polanski's work is the opening moment in the film The Ghostwriter. And I'm sitting there in my living room, you know, just sort of like this very benign, safe atmosphere, sitting on my couch, like eating a cookie or something, watching this opening scene of The Ghostwriter. And it's just this shot, this really kind of plain shot of a car on a ferry boat. And it just was beautiful. It just had this majesty and this way of being framed that to me felt so, you know, Polanski-ish. All of the dilemma is sort of caught up in that moment where I'm taking in something that I think is beautiful with this knowledge of his biography inside me. This was really surprising to me that the work was not terminally disrupted or ruined, really, by my knowledge. And so I started to write on it. You know, the dilemma is between hatred of the crime and love of the art. Those are the two elements that sort of have to be brought into balance. And for me, Polanski is such a stark embodiment of that contrast, right? The crime is so undeniably not okay, and the work to me is undeniably great. And so it was all held in that moment, the most perfect example of the dilemma. We reach for this way of talking about what happened. We find a language for accusation. And I don't at all poo-poo that language of accusation. I don't. You know, I think the ability to say what happened is incredibly important and valuable for all of us to hear. But more delicate and harder to talk about is this quality of love of the work, which I think is also sustaining and important. And I wanted to be a voice for both those ideas in this book.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Claire Dieterer is with us today. She's a book critic, a reporter, an essayist, author of the memoir called Poser. This new book is called Monsters, A Fan's Dilemma.
I think that when I first started to look at the question, I immediately went to get some expert help with it. I wrote an email to a former professor of mine. You know, I immediately went to someone else to ask if they could just solve this for me, right? And he wrote back very nicely and said, well, you might want to think about V.S. Naipaul or Ezra Pound. These are people whose, you know, biographies are maybe not always blameless. And as I was thinking about it, I realized, no, the problem wasn't that I wanted to make a list of people who'd done rotten things. And, you know, art history is already that. That already exists. Yeah. And so many artists I love have been, you know, revealed to have thought or said or done something difficult, as have we all, I will add, to different degrees, obviously. I don't want to totalize that. But I didn't want the book to just be this catalog of monsters for a couple reasons. One, I wasn't interested in just pointing my finger or just, you know, having sort of a righteous moment of telling other people what's wrong with them, which this book easily could have been. Yeah. That's one thing. And the other thing is doing that, writing that list would mean that all the attention is on them. Yeah. And I realized that what I was interested in is the experience of the audience. And it's not that I wanted all the attention to be on me. What I wanted to do was refocus the lens onto what is happening to the audience as we make our way through this seemingly contemporary minefield, but actually something that's been a minefield for a lot longer than that.
Yeah. Yeah. I think a lot of people are going to probably come to the book looking for permission or guidance or some kind of step-by-step instruction about what to do with the art, you know, that means something to them or a lot to them, yet was made by, you know, by a monster. I mean, you yourself say early on in the book that you wish there was this calculator you could find online and you plug in, you know, something that would measure basically the horrible nature of the crime against the greatness of the art, and then just spit out a verdict and say, oh, you'll be fine. You can watch a Woody Allen movie or whatever.
Or you absolutely cannot.
Yes, that's right. Exactly. But it doesn't exist, obviously. And this isn't, I just want you to say something about that. This isn't what you are doing. You're not really giving people permission or guidance or a step. But I guess what you're saying is you're working through how you've been thinking about that. And maybe that's going to be helpful for those of us who are also working through the same stuff. Is that right?
Yeah, I think that that's right. I think the kind of context in which I'm writing this book both simultaneously wants me to make a pronouncement and will destroy any pronouncement, right? So That said, for me, what I wanted to do was, as I said, focus on the experience of the audience. And the way I was thinking about that was this experience I had had where I had been watching the film Manhattan. I was thinking about this problem and I was thinking about Woody Allen.
Yeah.
And I watched Annie Hall successfully consumed that piece of art and enjoyed it. And then I was like, okay, I'm going to try Manhattan. And so I'm coming to Manhattan with my own experiences of having older men sexually prey on me as a teenager. And this is just vis-a-vis Allen's relationship with Sun Yi. None of this has to do with the accusation having to do with Dylan. This, you know, my complexity around Woody Allen began very early. And the Dylan thing is just, it's outside my area of knowledge, right? I can't know. So anyway, so coming to Manhattan as the person I was, it was very painful and very difficult. And also there were moments of surpassing beauty still. But for me, because of my knowledge of the work and also because of my own experiences, the viewing was just impossible, really, to take it in, you know, in an uncomplicated way. And there was, you know, I talked repeatedly with various men and Woody Allen fans, and they said, you have to separate the art from the artist.
Yeah.
And you have to take Manhattan on its own terms as a great work of art. And their perception is that they are objective. They think they're coming to this apprehension of the work from an objective point of view.
Yeah.
And that my experience is subjective. But the really central idea I'm getting at in the book is that every experience of art is subjective. We all come with our experiences. These men who were telling me that I ought to separate the art from the artist, whether they were people I know or things that I read, are, you know, white men. Piece of work is made by white men, consumed by white men, and criticized by white men for the most part, or reviewed by white men. So it's this kind of like perfect channel of communication where that notion of objectivity never gets disrupted because other voices don't enter that conversation, right? And when they do, they get called subjective or other. So really trying to bring forward that idea that every work of art is made by a specific person and consumed by a specific person. That's what I'm really trying to get at, is subverting that critical authority that tells us both, you know, this is a great work of art, making that decision for other people, and it is so great that you should be able to consume it in this prescriptive way, again, based on someone else's subjective experience. I can't make decisions about, you know, the Cosby Show if it's something that has shaped your experience as, you know, maybe in the 80s as a young Black person. Like, I can't tell you how you're supposed to feel. That's outrageous.
Yeah. It's so interesting. I think that the example of those two Woody Allen films, Annie Hall and Manhattan, are kind of perfect here to illustrate that. Because as you mentioned in the book, you saw a kind of brilliance in Annie Hall.
Yeah.
And, you know, the costumes and the language and the, and, you know, a younger Diane Keaton, right? Compared to Manhattan, which was an entirely different experience. Same artist, different reaction. That seems to say it all, I think, in some way, right?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I think it's, you're really then engaging with the work of art itself. And I think, you know, focusing on Diane Keaton in those two films is super fascinating. Because in Annie Hall, she is adored. And she's also neurotic in a way that is almost, you know, is allowed to be a protagonist, is allowed to be a very full human being in a way that almost feels like a reflection of the filmmaker Allen himself. You know, she's very complicated and full. And then in Coming to Manhattan, she appears again, but now she's this kind of brittle intellectual who is sort of made fun of throughout the film and shown in contrast. I mean, she's shown lovingly at times, to be fair, but she's overall is a kind of comic figure in a laughing at her kind of way, and definitely revealed in contrast to the sort of beautiful simplicity of Mary L. Hemingway. So Diane Keaton's character, because she's created as this kind of comic figure in a way that makes the love of this teenage Mariel Hemingway more acceptable. So she's used in that way in the film, which is really interesting.
Mm. Let's go back to the idea where you wanting to basically tell the story of the audience. And one of the things you write about is that you say that, and I don't know if there was a sort of turning point moment. I mean, you do write about 2016 and watching the Access Hollywood tape, you know, over and over and over again, and seeing this kind of static in the moment we're in right now. Also saying, by the way, that your response to all of that wasn't logical. I mean, that seemed like something that you thought about early on, that I can think this through. But it turned out that it was actually more an emotional response than anything else. But you also say about the audience, getting back to that, that the audience had sort of turned into something new. It had become a group. It had a new job. Say something about what you were seeing with the way the audience was transforming in this moment.
I think that there's a few different ways I'm talking about the collective audience in this book. And specifically at that moment where we were watching the Access Hollywood tape and they kept showing it over and do you remember that day? How they just showed over and over on the news?
Yes.
It was insane. And it was kind of early in our realization that this was going to be a show we were going to be watching for a while, right?
Yeah.
Like we were just coming to that realization, and that it was so outrageous. Nobody could believe that something so outrageous had happened to a presidential candidate. It's hard to remember now after everything that's happened. So it was just, you know, sitting there with my tea and toast or whatever, and just watching this looping thing and realize, you know, and then doing that new thing that we do as audience members where we watch and we look at social media at the same time. So I'm watching the conversation with Trump, and I didn't even realize it was assault until I saw some guy on Facebook call it that. What Trump was describing was assault. He's like, this is assault. And I think that initially it was so shocking to hear the language that he used, that seemed like the problem. But the problem wasn't the language. The problem was the action he was describing. Mm. So there was this way that we were feeling our way through this what the young people would call a rich text of this video together, right? We were making sense of it that afternoon. It was afternoon where I was when it was released. So there's this collective thinking that happens now that's really different. And then that night, this writer, Kelly Oxford, tweeted, women, tell me about your first assault.
Yeah.
And I was so struck by her language using the word first, the implication of a list. Mm-hmm. And so she put this up on Twitter, and she got, I think, millions of responses. There was some insane number of responses she got. I can't cite them now. It's in the book. And people just stating their first assault. And there was a way in which at that moment, the audience sort of joins together and becomes like a collective megaphone saying something that has happened, laying the groundwork for Me Too. And that's a way that the audience is a collective, you know, the audience that speaks back, the audience that thinks together, the audience that responds together. That's one thing that's really changed for us, I think, in this moment, or in this, I don't even want to say moment, it's just really in the era of the dominance of social media. The other thing that happens is that, you know, I think that fandoms have always been collective. Like, I think that if you're seeing the Beatles at Chase Stadium and you're a 14-year-old girl and you're sobbing, that experience is not just about you and the Beatles. It's about the thousands of other girls around you also sobbing. And it's a very collective experience, right? They're shared tears, and that's what gives them power and even gives them meaning.
Yeah.
But that collectivity of the fan has just really become both amplified and monetized by the internet, so that is such a way of being that we don't even necessarily think about it. are belonging to these sort of collective groups of fans.
As you describe it in the book, you say that the eye of the audience has to become we for it, for the market to work. Right. The other part that's interesting about that you write about the fan is that a fan is not just a consumer, but a fan is also being consumed, defined in some ways by art, and obsessed, which you kind of define in the book. And maybe say something about that, this real obsession, the kind of obsession that has actual stakes. How does this idea of obsession work with a fan? Say something about that and how a fan is consumed by the art, by their affection for this thing.
Well, I take apart the idea of obsession in the book. I talk about how we say we're obsessed with things and that it's become this almost currency we use on the internet. I'm obsessed with, you know, whatever, with my cat. I'm obsessed with, you know, this new song by Lana Del Rey, or, you know, I'm obsessed. And it becomes this way of asserting yourself as the ultimate fan. But the obsession and the self-definition through the artist is sort of a core dynamic of not just the internet, but broadcast media. You know, I write in the book about the idea of parasocial relationships, which is a term that is used more and more often on the internet. And the frequency of its use indicates its, you know, sort of growing reality. And parasocial relationship means that is this idea that we have these relationships with the artists we love and we feel like we're in an actual relationship with them. We have love for them and the love feels so real that it's almost as if they're speaking directly to us. And I found the history of this term super fascinating. The sociologists who write about it and the cultural writers who write about it trace it back to the beginning of broadcast media. And they talk about this problem when, for instance, radio began. Because say you're saying something to a group. Previous to radio, you would have had to stand in the same physical space as them and see them and they could see you. But this voice that can speak individually to hundreds, thousands, or millions of people and have this seeming one-to-one relationship creates these sort of emotional category errors in the audience or in the listener. And that kind of category error isn't just a function of our moment of social media, but it goes all the way back to feelings that came from early moments of broadcasting. And now, in our moment now, there's this way in which social media, you know, it's really important to remember that social media isn't like a floating public service. It's not like something that just occurs. It's an industry and someone's making money off of it. And that is, you know, we have these parasocial feelings toward the people we are, quote unquote, obsessed with. That is not just about the dynamic of us paying them for their art. It's about social media companies monetizing the actual love, the sort of moments and pixels and of our love. You know, that every minute we spend thinking about that, someone is making money off it. And then that creates this accelerating reality where there's just more and more and more of that kind of dynamic.
It's Claire Dieterer. Her new book is Monsters, A Fan's Dilemma. We'll take a break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West.
Here's an easy way to boost your monthly gift to KUER. Switch to a direct donation from your bank account. Your support won't be interrupted due to lost cards or expiration dates, and when you do switch, you'll help KUER save thousands of dollars each year by offsetting steep processing fees. Most importantly, you're strengthening your support of the essential local news and NPR programming you depend on. Make the switch today at KUER.org/membership.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, Claire Dieterer is with us talking about her new book called Monsters, A Fan's Dilemma. It came from an essay she wrote a few years ago for the Paris Review, where she asks, what are you supposed to do if you love someone's art, their music, their movies or paintings? I mean, really love it, but they've done something terrible. Dieterer works through the puzzle of how to behave when confronted with the contradictory imperatives of wanting to be a virtuous consumer and a citizen of the world of art. There's this other thing that you say about an audience that I think is important to mention. You write that it could be that the audience feels in its heart that this is pure and righteous and true. But there's also a bit of self-congratulation going on there that people need to at least acknowledge. And this is how you put it in the book. You say that psychic theater of the public condemnation of monsters can be seen as a kind of elaborate misdirection, that it's only about them. Well, say what you mean by that, because I think this is an important point.
I think I'm playing with this idea of the divided self. I think I even bring up the Victorian idea of Jekyll and Hyde, you know, the sort of good self and the bad self, and that you present the good self to the world, but there's this knowledge of the bad self inside. And there's almost, especially in this sort of culture of potential shame that we live in with this, you know, sort of sword of Damocles of the internet always hanging over us. Sorry, I'm mixing metaphors, but there's sort of a camouflaging thing of like, look over there, don't look at me. Mm. I'm going to point at that person, and therefore I'm going to be good. I actually talked to this really brilliant young writer last week who writes for a magazine called Document Magazine, and she said something really smart about this look over there thing. Mm. But another aspect that she brought up was this idea that when you say, look over at that monster, you're doing a performance of sympathy with the victim, right? You're showing sympathy for the victim. But there might be something more useful you could do for the victim.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, it's an interesting question. It's there's a lot of kind of framing of the pointer in that pointing, if that makes sense.
Mm. You say there's a certain kind of person who seems would be immune to this stain, as you describe it in the book, and that's the genius. Let's talk a little bit about that. There's a section where you write about the genius, you know, and often it's this exclusive club that doesn't include women. And this gets us to Picasso. This gets us to Hemingway. Maybe say something about the Best of Life photo book that you saw when you were 6 or 7.
I have this memory of lying on the floor in my parents' house, in my house when I was little, thumbing my way through the Best of Life photo book. So that's a collection of photographs from Life magazine. And, you know, I think for younger listeners, they're so used to the proliferation of images, they don't understand how powerful, or they might not understand how powerful such a collection could be. You know, we didn't have the internet. We had the photo book, The Best of Life, if we wanted to look at a conglomeration of photos. Or we had, you know, there were very few places where we could go to kind of rummage around in images like that. So I was paging through it, and on one page, there's a photo of Picasso using some kind of, I don't know if it's a flashlight or a piece of fire or what he's using, but he's quickly drawn in the air the image of a centaur in front of him. And you can see him peering through this image made with light. And he just has these incredibly sparkling eyes. And he's muscular and he looks like he's ready to play. He's sort of crouched and he also looks a little bit scary. And then like a page later, you turn the page and there's Hemingway walking down a road in Ketchum, Idaho, where he would eventually shoot himself. And he's kicking a can. And he just has this, again, this just incredible sort of full inhabiting of his body, where he's using his whole body to kick this can. And he also looks like a kid in a funny way. And he also looks scary. And yeah. I remember being really taken with these images as a tiny little girl. You know, I just was some little girl who was whiling away a boring afternoon. But these, I would look at these images over and over. And these images, these sort of physical, masculine, uninhibited men became my idea of what the artist slash what the genius looked like.
Yeah, I think that the power of the bad boy was interesting. You mentioned even George and Jerry knew the power of the bad boy, which was a reference that I loved. And I think everyone will get for the most part.
But I think so too. The part where George is trying to be the bad boy and Jerry's like, well, you've been the bad son, the bad friend.
Exactly.
Why not the bad boy?
Yeah. But you say maybe we've created the idea of genius to serve our own attraction to badness. So there's something there that may explain this affection for some of us anyway, for, you know, someone like Hemingway, I guess.
I think one thing I'm getting at, aside from the specifics of various rotten behaviors,
yes,
I think that there's this way in which the genius is this construction that is sort of we agree upon, that's not so much a sort of category of kind of or a kind of person, but a sort of status of person. Mm-hmm. The genius is the person who gets to do whatever he wants. You know, he's
right.
The person who is subject to artistic impulses and to some kind of like exterior voice telling him how to make this work. We can call that voice artistic impulse or the muse or some kind of artistic energy. But he, in any case, is channeling something when he makes his work. And popular images, like think of that image of Picasso drawing in the air. He's
yep.
responding to an impulse. He's free. He's unfettered. It's a total license. And the flip side of that, or alongside that, is sort of the idea that, well, if that license, that kind of freedom brings us what we want, this incredibly free, expressive art, then we also have to accept the other license that he
yeah.
might be acting on, which is, you know, hurting other people.
Right.
And we see those two things as collapsed and necessary to each other.
But then you tell this story that really gets to the crux of the matter. For me, it did anyway, where you had taken your kids to see an exhibit of Picasso at the Vancouver Art Gallery. And your kids who saw Picasso, who saw this art, didn't encounter it without all of that other baggage, because they're on the information cards that went along with the paintings were the terrible things that Picasso had done. So they couldn't just experience it without that. Not that they should necessarily or would, but it is interesting that they didn't. And they didn't care for Picasso. And it was hard to, right? I mean, so why didn't they? Is it because he was a monster? You can see it written out. I don't know. Do you think that's a shame that they didn't encounter Picasso, just the art there? Look, here it is. What do you think about that without knowing the baggage? What do you make of this? I guess, what are you getting at with this story, do you think?
I think that it's fantastic that the placards were there to give them the information.
I
think that, you know, the kids will come back to Picasso if they need to come back to Picasso. I think that this, and maybe this makes me just a tool of the lab. The kind of ongoing framing that we're seeing in museums now about the work that we're looking at, whether that has to do with giving biographical context for the work, or, you know, what we're often starting to see now is acknowledgement of how the museum acquired the work. That's a big movement in museums right now. And I think that if we're going to live in this moment of this onslaught of biography, I think the using of that biography in a thoughtful way in cultural institutions is a fantastic thing. Yes, it bummed my children out, but maybe on some other level, they just didn't care for the work that much.
Right. But how can you tell?
Well, you can't tell, but I I think that while I do see your point that there might be something they've lost in the loss of the chance to experience the work unmitigated, I think what is gained through that kind of cultural context is really powerful.
Yeah.
And that we can trust people to manage.
Yeah.
You know, maybe we can't trust 11-year, you know, teenagers or preteens or whatever they were who also would really like to go have an ice cream. Like, maybe we can't trust them to manage those kinds of complexities, but I think we can trust audiences to do that.
Claire Dieterer, her new book is Monsters, The Fan's Dilemma. We'll take another break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West.
One of the things that you can count on from KUBR is that we've got your back when it comes to reporting the news. And one of the things that KUBR counts on to keep it all going? Contributions from listeners. One way that you can help is to donate a vehicle that you no longer need. It's free, it's easy to do, and it could be worth hundreds of dollars in support. The process is simple. Learn more and get started today at KUBR.org/vehicle.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back now to our conversation with Claire Dieterer. We're talking about her new book, Monsters, A Fan's Dilemma. There's a section in the book I really liked called The Critic. And this is where you write a bit about your own experience of becoming a critic. And I wanted to ask you about the story you tell about Ms. Smith. Because you say that she may have been the person who made you a critic. And it gets us to this idea so important in the book of subjectivity. Tell us about this experience, if you would.
Oh, yeah. Well, first, I want to say that this woman, she was my English teacher in seventh or eighth grade, and this was in the 70s. And, you know, Seattle, which was, it's hard to indicate what a backwater Seattle was in this time. We didn't even really get traveling productions of plays. We didn't get, bands didn't come to town. We were just in the West and everyone forgot about us.
Right.
And I had certainly never encountered an intellectual before. And I had really never encountered a female intellectual before. So here was this lady, just frizzy hair and cool glasses and kind of holding the chalk between her fingers like she was going to smoke it. Like she was just really, and just sharp as a tack and constantly making critical pronouncements. And so I was handing in an assignment or something after class, or she asked me to stay behind for some reason. And I was in seventh grade, and she said, you know, she was like, you know, Claire, you think about things so much and so hard. You think about them until you find something wrong with them. That might be a problem for you for the rest of your life. And she did sort of anoint me a critic at that moment, where she was like, here, you're going to think about things really hard and find what's wrong with them.
How important is the idea of subjectivity in all of this? Because you spend a good bit of the book talking about that. Like, you explore the idea of how to solve, you know, the problems of monstrous men. Do you do it by thinking or do you do it by feeling? And that's the tension, I guess. You mentioned that this is a tension that constantly playing out, I guess. So talk about the role of the importance of subjectivity.
You know, I brought up earlier this idea that there's this sort of often authoritative voice saying separate the art from the artist and, you know, focus on the fact that it's great work. And really, you know, the opening of the book is a series of necessary steps to kind of set up the terms of the argument. And I really needed at the opening of the book to interrogate this idea that someone gets to say what is great art and decide that for everyone else.
Yeah.
And so I thought about my own experiences as a critic. I started out my career as a movie critic when I was in my mid-20s. And even at that time in the 90s, I was one of the only female critics, and I felt very unsure of myself, despite having been told by Ms. Smith I was a natural critic. so I was constantly questioning myself, and I wrote out of a deep subjectivity. And part of that subjectivity was my natural way of looking at things. And part of it was an expression of this idea that had been instilled in me that as a woman, my voice was non-central,
right? Mm-hmm. That I was not the critical authority. So I was foregrounding my own perspective to kind of own that and acknowledge it in my review. And at the same time, I just was really already aware that my reaction to a piece of work, whether it's a film or a book or whatever, as an audience member was more interesting and more important than a critical pronouncement.
Yeah.
Like if I could watch a movie and feel it, be scared in the scary parts, be sad in the sad parts, laugh in the funny parts, you know, really respond as an audience, that was going to put me in a position to have a more pure relationship with my reader, to tell them what this piece of art was like and my true response to it. So these were all things that lined up to make me focus on my subjective response. And I didn't think it through at the time, but in retrospect, I think that subjectivity is such a valid place for criticism to come, you know, for critical writing to happen from and for our viewing to come from. And I think that this idea, I think we can go further than that and acknowledge that there is no objective criticism to be written.
Yeah.
There is not one person who can decide this is a great work of art. We can have a consensus, but I can't tell you that you ought to think something, you know, that you ought to see things exactly from my point of view. And the idea that there is a central perspective is just a myth that's been created by the people who've held power. And they believe in the centrality of their own perspective and are totally unable to see that they too are acted upon by history, by race, by class, by gender. Mm-hmm. It's just that their perspective has been so central for so long, they don't see it as subjective. So that kind of that exploration of subjectivity within the context of the critic was really coming from that point of view of who gets to say.
Yeah.
And then growing from there into a larger engagement with the question, allowing that subjectivity to be sort of find its fullest expression in love of the work. You know, that we each get to experience and decide upon based on our own biographies. And I really want to bring forward this idea that when a work of art is consumed, the biography of the maker is present, but the biography of the consumer or the audience member is also present. And this occurs in every instance, you know, whether we're aware of it and whether we want it to. And I think that, you know, starting out with that idea of critical subjectivity is the basis of that idea, and then growing it into this idea that, yes, we feel and experience love for this work, and that's valuable.
Yeah.
And personal.
Right. Oh, I want to underline that idea of love. You write about Miles Davis in the book, and this essay by the playwright, Black playwright Pearl Clegg. It's called Mad at Miles. You say the piece was kind of just what you had been looking for. So maybe explain what it was in that piece that helped you think about what you yourself were supposed to do with, you know, Kind of Blue, you know, Miles Davis, and the fact that there were serious questions about his behavior.
Yeah. And I mean, in the case of Davis, like, it's not really questions because he writes about
it. No, I shouldn't say that. Yeah, I shouldn't have put it that way. You're right. Yeah.
Yeah.
You're right.
He's the first person to say it. And I will also add that his biography is brilliantly well written, which further complicates the whole dynamic. He's this sort of incredible writer writing about his incredible career and telling about really incredibly bad behavior.
Yeah. Yeah.
So it's a sort of stunning book. I came across this essay, which is it's called Mad at Miles. And she talks about her experiences as a Black woman coming to Miles's work, coming to it with a knowledge of the abuse, but she didn't know about it till she'd already fallen in love with the work. Somebody played Miles for her, and Miles began to shape her days and even her years. And she talks about how his music was so essential for the various phases of her life, you know, the part where she's leaving a long relationship, the part where she's starting to date again, the part where she's, you know, going a little bananas because dating's so hard. And Miles sort of accompanies her through all of this. And I think that this is such a powerful idea Because I think we've all been there with music. You know, it's often music that affects us deeply like this because we do live alongside it. And it does kind of come to define certain eras of our own lives in a way that's utterly unique among the various art form or the various arts. And so Clegg is talking about this dynamic, and then she's talking about the dawning realization of the awfulness of Miles. And she's just, you know, the essay is very brilliantly well written. She describes the dynamic really well. She describes how she doesn't want to be mad at a Black man as a Black woman. She talks about her desire to not be angry. But most of all, she just talks about how furious she is.
Yeah.
And there's something in her ability to focus the essay toward feeling, but written in this incredibly smart way that not only clarified my own approach to the problem, it really, really helped me think about my sense that emotion is at the key to the whole whole situation, that our feelings cannot be ignored. It gave me permission to enter my own relationship with the artists I care about. I mean, I think that by focusing, she's really a model of what I've been thinking about through the whole book. She's not making a pronouncement about we ought to do about Miles, and she's not making a pronouncement about whether or not the art is great. She's saying, here's why it mattered to me, and here's my emotional response to it. And that gave me permission to engage with the artists I love in the same way. And that, in turn, became the objective of my book. I don't know what other people should do. I don't have the answer. I'm not solving this for everyone, and I'm certainly not solving it artist by artist. But what I'm hoping I'm doing is continuing this conversation that Clegg opened with me. I'm hoping to continue it with the reader. And then the reader, of course, is going on to think about the work and continue to talk to the people around them about what they think, but more than that, what they feel.
This all made me wonder if you make a distinction between the relationship, you know, that we have with those people in our everyday lives, people we know or knew, you know, parents or siblings or boyfriends or girlfriends, you know, et cetera, who may have done monstrous things, and the relationship we have with, you know, Miles Davis or Woody Allen or Picasso, you know, artists we never met or knew. Is there a distinction between those relationships beyond the obvious circumstance? Because it's one of the things that it seems like you had this insight when you were talking with your friend Sam. You were at this cabin and the subject of your book, Monsters, came up, and he mentioned his stepfather, Fred. And I just thought that seemed to – Fred wasn't a – you know, wasn't an artist necessarily that – I don't know if he was, but I mean, he was his stepfather. So – say something about that, if you would.
I'd been working on the book for a while, and I was like sitting around the campfire with my friend. And actually, he came and found me there and came with this kind of intense look on his face and wanted to talk about this. He said, are you still writing this book about the monster artists? And I said, yes. And he said, it made me think about my stepfather, who was, you know, a really, really bad guy, a violent guy, a guy who made Sam's life really difficult as a kid. I mean, Dickensianly difficult, very dark. And Fred ended up in prison, and it just is a very bad situation. And Sam's point was, I love him. I mean, that was all he had come to find me to say, was I love him. And it was such an important moment for me in the writing of the book. It made, you know, because first of all, you know, I was happy my friend had told me this complex thing about their past, but also it made me once again reconnect with the primacy of the idea of love in the context of what we know that's wrong. Mm. It also made me think about, it then made me think about the people in my own life who maybe I have found to be difficult or, you know, less than perfect, because nobody is that, and how my relationship to them had changed. But also, and crucially, you know, what had I done wrong? What would my kids look at? I mean, you know, I didn't end up in prison, but what would my kids look at and say, this was hard?
you know, because we all have stuff. And that moment of talking to him opened up this idea that the problem of what we do with the art of monsters is a kind of laboratory for this much more crucial human question about what we do with the difficult people in our lives, and also how difficult can we be before people stop loving us?
Yeah. Which brings up one story that I loved, and it's you and your daughter are at this crepe place, and there's this, the young woman behind the counter, and your daughter and her have this, you know, kind of connection to the band Power Bottom. And her response, I don't know, tell that story, I guess, finally, because that seemed to me to say it all, I thought.
Yeah. Thank you. We're at the crepe place. We live in a small town, so everybody knows everybody else. So
yeah.
She's spreading the batter on the big pan and making us our crepes. Anyway, so she and my daughter start talking about Power Bottom. And Power Bottom was this band they loved, and there'd been a credible accusation against them, or let's just say an accusation or two against them about predating female fans. And the other girl, Hannah, and my daughter were talking and sort of discussing the latest developments in the case and the accusations. And I think at this point it had been a while since the accusations had been made. And Hannah just sort of, the crepe making girl just sort of looked into the distance and just said really thoughtfully, "I still love them, even after everything." And, you know, I was working on my book already at this point, and she said that phrase, "even after everything." And I swear, you know, the hairs on my arm stood up. I was just, that's it. Even after everything, that's what we're sort of, there's this aftermath quality to this problem. Even after everything, you know, the sort of wave of knowledge, the wave of accusation, the wave of biography passes. And then here we are sort of standing on the shore left with something we love, even after everything.
Claire Dieterer, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Claire Dieterer, her new book is Monsters, A Fan's Dilemma. Radio West is a production of KUER. You can subscribe to the show wherever you get your podcasts. And as always, we'd love to hear from you. We're on Twitter at Radio West. The program is produced by Benjamin Bombard and Tim Slover. Carrie Watson is our executive producer. I'm Doug Fabrizio.